Okay, so we're going to, like I said, we're going to start the Chronicles of Narnia, The Magician's Nephew. No one ever did a movie yet on The Magician's Nephew.
They should, because
they
it's a
did
really
not.
Good one.
It is a really good one, but they did not do a movie. Okay, C.S. Lewis. Just to give you a quick background, C.S. Lewis was a Wives Staples was his name. Yes. He was a professor back in, probably the 40s or so, and 50s, back in England, okay? I think he was at Oxford, And very, very brilliant, well-respected amongst all of his peers, did not believe in God, okay? Not one bit. And what he did was essentially said, if I'm going to not believe in God, I've got to be able to defend what I say, and I've got to be able to know what I believe. And so he went through, basically, and read through the Bible and started to say, this actually makes sense. Logically, archaeologically, a lot of other things kind of come together that I just didn't think were even in here. And he worked through, essentially, the Holy Spirit worked through him in a very logical manner. And then he began to understand so fast. This man was a brilliant, brilliant man. He began to understand so fast that he could put it into terms. And this is the genius, in my mind, of a person who can use an allegory. So who knows what an allegory is?
I did at one point the last time we talked about this stuff.
But now you don't.
I'm sure it's a story that represents something else.
Okay, so story with representation.
Yes.
It represents... It represents something else. So, in other words, it's not perfect. Not every single word means something specific, but the story overall, and sometimes conversations directly, have direct impact and direct connection to what we believe and how we think. Usually what C.S. Lewis did was wrote these books called The Chronicles of Narnia, and he wrote several other ones. He wrote a space trilogy, and then he wrote a plethora of other books about thinking. A lot of it are just outright thinking. He wrote these books. They were put out as children's books, but if you read them, a child can understand the story, but in our church, our adult class also goes through them sometimes. Different ones, it goes through and picks out the biblical meanings, because the story is so captivating and so good in most every one of them that it well illustrates, and it's difficult to forget. Once you get it, you're like, oh yeah, that is true. And you see it in the character. So he has perfect character development, and that's really one of the big pieces of an allegory that makes it good. He has great character development. And you find that throughout most all of his books, he specifically writes a character in a certain way, and you see that character grow, and sometimes you grow to hate that character, or sometimes grow to love that character. And it's just the way he writes them, okay? And you'll find we're going to meet a few characters tonight as we get into the story. One of them, the main character, probably overall, is his name is Diggory. Okay, so Diggory is a young boy. He's going to school, and he is kind of a sad young boy. He used to live in the country. He used to love where he lived, and now he moved into the city. His father is away in India. His mother is very sick, so she can't take care of him. So they moved in with his uncle, Andrew.
He's thinking Arnold, but...
Okay, so he has an uncle, Andrew, who is kind of a crazy, loony professor that stays up in the attic. He's not allowed to go visit him. And there's a door, a study, that he go that this Uncle Andrew is up in there all the time. He's not allowed to look even up there. Not allowed to be there. Not allowed to go there. Not even allowed to spy on his uncle. Okay? So, in fact, we'll find that his uncle may not be that cheery, good type of crazy. He's kind of actually a little bit bad in the way he thinks, okay? So Uncle Andrew is there. And then Polly Plummer. She is, or turns out to be, one of Diggory's good friends, okay? So these are your three main characters to start with. And of course, Uncle Andrew has a wife. I think she's Aunt Letty. Okay? And you'll find most of these are kind of set in a British theme, although you'll hear some words here and there that may not be as good or as used as we would use them. They might mean something a little bit different. All right? And then also Diggory's mom. Okay? He's got a mom. She's very sick. And really, she's referred to multiple times. As we go through the book, you'll find more characters. But really, tonight, that's all you're going to meet. All right? You're going to see what happens. Now, Uncle Andrew lives in a row house. So, this is just for your information. In the city, oftentimes, they'll build row housing. And I guess they call them condos in some places. But essentially, it's one great big house, and there are multiple sections of it. Each one is multiple stories, typically, and they're all connected together. Okay? And a family lives in each one. And so you go and you get maybe three stories in each house, but they're narrow. They might be only as wide as this room. They're one room wide, and they go up and up and up, okay? So, this is important in the first part of the story because Polly lives in one of these, okay? Polly lives in one of these, and Uncle Andrew lives in another one, and that's where Diggory is. And there's some distance, and there's a vacant one in between somewhere. And, of course, as kids will do, they figure out that, hey, there's probably something really amazing in that. They're probably hiding something in the vacant one. All right? And you'll have to listen. There's always an explanation. They say that the adults give some sort of explanation, but the adults' explanations are always stupid and boring. And that's what they say, because her dad thinks it's the plumbing is bad in it, so nobody lives there because of the plumbing. And they, of course, think there's pirates or some sort of great treasure. So, what there is here online, there's a radio theater done with this. It's not exact word for word of the book. We're going to order a few books so you guys can have books if you don't have them. You can also go online and look up, and I apologize, I have it here, I just don't have the web address, but we can get that to you, and I'll put it up on the board, and you can listen to it. The whole thing is only 2.5 hours, and they tell the entire story. Slightly abridged. The book has a little bit more. We're going to go and get the book and read into the book a few little details sometimes that they might leave out, but it really gives a really good story, okay? So, I'm going to attempt, and hopefully this gives you enough noise with my thing to play a little bit of this.
Hello, I'm Douglas Gresham, your host for Focus on the Family Radio Theater. I'm sure you can imagine the scene. A small boy tucked away in his playroom on a rainy afternoon, creating an intricate world of fantasy with stories about a mythological kingdom called Boxen that had talking animals and chivalrous knights. We often take children's imaginative adventures for granted. We may even consider them silly or childish. But for Clive Staples Lewis, or Jack, as he insisted on being called at the age of 4, those days of playful fantasy were very important. They would, in fact, become the basis of stories he would write years later while he was a teacher at Oxford University. We know them, of course, as the Chronicles of Narnia. One need only read the various books, diaries, and letters of Jack's life to see how his childhood in Belfast, Ireland, in the early part of the 20th century, influenced the magician's nephew, the story you're about to hear. The wonder and secrets found in an attic. A young boy trying to cope with the terrible illness of his mother, and an escape into a newly created world. These are things that the young Jack Lewis knew personally. And so did I, for like Jack, I lost my own mother when I was young. Her name was Joy Gresham, and she was the wife of Jack Lewis. I remember well living in Jack's house in Oxford while he was writing The Magician's Nephew, how he would often bring down from his study whatever chapter he'd just finished writing, and the chats we'd have about it. For me, it was always a delight, because I loved the Narnian stories, even before I'd ever met their author.
So yes, Lewis's stepson, okay, that's who this is.
1955. Though it was the sixth book of the seven to be written, it is really the first book of the world of Narnia. Here, Jack Lewis explores not only themes of creation, beauty and hope, but of corruption, betrayal, and ultimately, forgiveness. So if you're tempted to think that these stories are for children only, then you're sadly mistaken. Jack observed that as an adult, he enjoyed so-called children's stories better than he did as a child. He said he was able to put more into them, and as a result, he got more out of them. Join us now as Focus on the Family Radio Theatre proudly presents The Magician's Nephew. This is a story about something that happened long ago when your grandfather was a child. It's a very important story because it shows how all the comings and goings between our own world and a land called Narnia first began. In those days, Mr. Sherlock Holmes was still living in Baker Street, and if you were a boy in school, you had to wear a stiff collar every day. Schools were usually nastier than now, you see. But meals were nicer. And as for sweets, I won't tell you how cheap and good they were because it would only make your mouth water in vain. And in those days, there lived in London a girl called Polly Plummer. She lived in one of a long row of houses which were all joined together. One morning, she was out in the back garden when a boy scrambled up from the garden next door and put his face over the wall. Polly was very surprised. She looked up, full of curiosity. The face of the strange boy was very grubby. It could hardly have been grubbier if he'd first rubbed his hands in the earth and then had a good cry and then dried his face with his hands. As a matter of fact, this was very nearly what he had been doing.
At least I wash my face, which is what you need to do, especially since you've been... Go on. Say it. I didn't mean that...
Since I've been blubbing, that's what you were going to say. Well, it's true. I don't care who knows it.
Oh. You've cried...
Crying,
to
okay,
like
in English.
...and had a pony, and a rainbow at the bottom of the garden, and then been brought to live in a beastly hole like this. And if your father was away in India, and you'd have to come and live with an aunt and an uncle who's mad... And if the reason was that they were looking after your mother, and your mother was ill and was going to die.
I didn't know. I'm sorry. Until you peeked over the wall, I didn't know anyone lived with Miss Kettley and Mr. Kettley. I thought they were what I mean to say.
You thought they were an old bachelor and an old maid. That's because they are. It's an old house with old things, and nobody younger than they are should live in it.
Is your uncle really mad?
Either he's mad, or there's something else going on.
What makes you say that?
He has a study up in the attic, and Aunt Letty says I must never go up there.
Grown-ups always have rooms they won't let children into.
Yes, but last night, I was going past the foot of the attic stairs on my way to bed, and I heard a terrible yell.
Honestly?
Perhaps he keeps a mad wife shut up there. I've thought of that.
Or perhaps he makes counterfeit money.
Or he might have been a pirate.
Like the man at the beginning of Treasure Island.
Right. The one who was hiding from his shipmates.
Oh, I say, how exciting. I never knew your house was so interesting. You may think it's interesting, but you wouldn't like it if you had to live there. Would you like to visit my house sometimes? All my friends are away on holiday for the summer. They've been so dreary. Yes, I would like that. Then come over. Right now, if you like. All right. Would you mind if I washed my face first? Not at all.
That was how Polly and Diggory got to know one another. And as it was just the beginning of the summer holidays and neither of them was going away, they met nearly every day. Unfortunately, the summer also turned out to be one of the wettest and coldest there had been for years. That drove them to do indoor things. It's wonderful how much exploring you can do with a stump of candle in a big house or in a row of houses. Polly already had been exploring even before she met Diggory, and one rainy day she decided to show him what she had found.
Come on, then. I do wish you'd tell me what your secret is. You'll see for yourself in a minute. It's in here. This is your attic.
So they go up in the attic and all the attics are connected.
Hello. Behind here. What is it? A door to a cupboard? It leads to a secret room. Come in. Mind your head. Just squeeze past the water. Now, you have to step on the boards I put down. Otherwise, you'll fall through the rafters to the room below. Where's the light coming from? Between the stakes of the roof. That's why it floats. Don't you see? Then the eaves of the house. I call it my smuggler's cave. I brought up all these packing cases and chairs myself. Then I put these bottles of ginger beer all around so it looks more like a pirate's den. What's this? It's my cash box, where I keep my treasures. It's a good cave, Polly. But how long does this tunnel go on for? I mean, does it stop where your house ends? No, it goes on. I don't know how far, though. Then we could go the length of the whole row of houses. So we could. Oh, I say!
What?
We could get into the other houses.
Yes, and get taken up for burglars. No thanks.
Don't be so jolly clever. I was thinking of the house beyond yours.
What about it?
It's the empty one. My daddy says it's always been empty since we came here. I think it might be haunted.
Oh. Well, I suppose we ought to have a look at it then.
All right. Don't, if you'd rather not. I'm game if you are.
Oh. But how are we to know when we've reached the empty house?
I suppose we could count the rafters along the length of my house. And since all the houses are the same width, we'll know how many rafters it takes to go past your house. And then we'll reach the empty one. Good idea.
And so they did. They measured the attic of Folly's house, then had to get a pencil and do a sum.
Right.
They both got different answers to it at first. And even when they agreed, I'm not sure they got it right, they were in a hurry to start on the exploration.
Okay, let's start again.
Though they had little chinks of light coming through the slates of the roof, they each took a candle because it was such an important occasion.
16.
Then they carefully made their way down the tunnel, counting as they stepped from rafter to rafter.
20. I don't believe the house is really empty at all. I expect someone lives there in secret, only coming in and out at night with a dark lantern. We shall probably discover a gang of desperate criminals and get a reward. Oh, it's all rot to say a house would be empty all those years, unless there was some mystery. Daddy thought it must be the drains. Oh, pooh. Grown-ups are always thinking of uninteresting explanations.
Oh, no. I've lost count.
Oh.
I think we'll visit your house now.
Are you sure? Oh, we must have gone further than my house by now.
Diggory, look. It's that door. Let's have a look.
I've never seen a door like this in ours. It must be a door to the attic of the empty house. Shall I open it?
I'm game if you are.
There's no handle or bolt. Hold your candle up so I can see.
There's a latch near the top.
Well spotted. Oh, it's stuck. Oh, wait. There we are.
The door swung open. And the sudden daylight made them blink.
Then, with a great shock, they saw they were looking not into a deserted attic, but into a furnished room. But it seemed empty enough. The room was so quiet that you noticed the ticking of the clock at once. Polly's curiosity got the better of her. She blew out her candle and stepped into the strange room.
Polly, where are you going? It's all right. There's no one here.
It was shaped, of course, like an attic, but furnished as a sitting room. Every bit of the walls was lined with shelves, and every bit of the shelves was full of books. A fire was burning in the grate, and in front of the fireplace, with its back towards them, was a high-backed armchair. Between the chair and Polly, and filling most of the middle of the room, was a big table piled with all sorts of things. Printed books, and books of the sort you write in, and ink bottles and pens and sealing wax, and a microscope. But what she noticed first was a bright red wooden tray with a number of rings on it. They were in pairs, a yellow one and a green one together, then a little space, and then another yellow one and another green one. They were no bigger than ordinary rings, and no one could help noticing them because they were so bright. They were the most beautifully shiny little things you can imagine.
Well, this is no good. It's not an empty house at all. We'd better make it before anyone comes. Listen, Diggory. Do you hear that?
What?
Listen. That humming sound. I think it's coming from these rings.
Oh, come on. The sooner...
Diggory never finished what he was going to say, for at that moment, the high-backed chair in front of the fire moved suddenly, and there rose up out of it, like a stage-play demon coming up out of a trapdoor, the alarming form of a man. He was very tall and thin, with a long, clean-shaven face, a sharply pointed nose, and extremely bright eyes beneath a great, tousled mop of grey hair.
Uncle Andrew!
My boy?
Oh, I don't think we went far enough, Diggory.
I think you went just the right distance. Send it. There. Now my foolish sister won't be able to interrupt us.
Run, boy. Back through the rafters.
Oh, no! You just got here. Why leave me so soon? I am delighted to see you. Two children are just what I wanted.
Please, Mr. Kettley. It's nearly my dinner time. I've got to go home. Will you let us out, please?
Oh, not just yet. This is too good an opportunity to miss. You see, I'm in the middle of a great experiment. I tried it on a guinea pig, and it seemed to work. But then a guinea pig can't tell you anything. And you can't explain to it how to come back.
Look here, Uncle Andrew. It really is dinner time, and they'll be looking for us in a moment. You must let us out.
Must? Oh, well, yes. If you really want to go, I suppose I should let you. I can't expect two youngsters like you to find it much fun talking to an old duffer like me. You've no idea how lonely I sometimes am. But no matter. Go on.
Well...
Oh, but I must give you a present before you go. Not every day I see a little girl in my dingy old study. Especially, if I may say so, such a very attractive young lady as yourself. Wouldn't you like one of those rings, my dear?
What? Do you mean one of those yellow or green ones?
Yes, those. Not a green one. Can't give them away just now. But I'd be delighted to give you any of them. Hello, ones. With my love. Come and try one on.
They are lovely.
Yes, they are.
Polly, listen. That humming noise is coming from the rings.
What a funny thought, my dear. There you go. Just try on that yellow one there.
Polly, don't be a fool. Don't touch them. But...
It was too late. Immediately, without a flash or a noise or a warning of any sort, there was no Polly. It was so sudden and so horribly unlike anything that had ever happened to Diggory, even in a nightmare, that he did what any of us would have done under the circumstances.
Ah! None of that. You start making a noise, your mother will hear it. I know what a fright might do to her. Understood?
Understood.
That's better.
She's gone, Uncle Andrew. She's disappeared. Right in front of my eyes.
I know, I know. It is a shock when you first see someone vanish. Why, he even gave me a turn when the guinea pig did it the other night.
Was that when you yelled?
Oh, you heard that, did you? I hope you haven't been spying on me.
No, I haven't. But what's happened to Polly?
Congratulate me, my dear boy. My experiment has succeeded. The little girl's gone. Vanished. Right out of the world.
What have you done for her?
Sent her to... well, to another place.
What do you mean?
Well, I'll tell you all about it. Have you ever heard of my godmother, old Mrs. Le Fay?
Wasn't she a great aunt or something? My mother doesn't like to talk about her. Was there something wrong with her?
Well, it depends what you call wrong. People are so narrow-minded, that's why they shut her up.
In an asylum, you mean?
Oh, no, 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 nothing of that sort. Only in prison.
Prison? What had she done?
Poor woman. She was very unwise. There were a good many different things. We needn't go into all of them now. She was always very kind to me.
But what's this have to do with Polly?
Well, a great deal. Right before she died, Mrs. Le Fay gave me a box that she kept in a secret drawer. The moment I picked up the box, I could tell by the tingling in my fingers that I held something wonderful in my hands. Of course, her intention was for me to destroy the box unopened. I promised her so she would allow me to keep it, but that promise I would not keep.
That was jolly rotten of you.
Rotten? Oh, I see. Oh, you mean that people ought to keep their promises? Oh, very true. Most right and proper, I'm sure. But you must understand that rules of that sort, however excellent for most people in general, can't possibly be expected to apply to profound students and great thinkers and sages. No, Diggory, men like me are freed from common rules.
All that means is that you think you can do anything you like to get anything you want.
Well, to the small-minded, I suppose it looks that way.
Will you tell me about Polly or not?
Oh, how you do harp on that, as if that was what mattered. Look, I'm attempting to tell you a remarkable story, and you go on about the girl. Listen, my boy, it took me years to discover the truth about that box. Was it Greek, or Babylonian, or Hittite, or Chinese? No, it was older than any of those nations. Do you know where it came from? The lost island of Atlantis.
What?
That means it's older than any of that Stone Age rubbish they dig up in Europe. It goes back to a time of great cities and palaces and temples and learned men who understood magic.
Magic?
Oh, I've studied it, you know. Magic. I've had some devilish experiences. That's what turned my hair grey. I never become a magician easily. My health broke down in the end. But I got better. And by then, I knew about the box, that it contained something that had been brought from another world when our world was just beginning. I don't mean another planet. I mean another world. Another nature. Another universe. Somewhere you could never reach, even if you traveled the space of our universe forever. It's a world that could be reached only by magic. The contents of that box held magic. The dust of another world. Can you imagine it? Oh, I didn't touch the dust. I was too clever for that. From it, I was able to make the rings. The yellow ones will send any creature that touches them into the other world. And I expect green ones will bring that creature back again. How can I be certain? How can I know what the other world was like? No matter how many guinea pigs I sent, they couldn't speak. Even if they did somehow touch the green ring to come back. I needed someone to send who could go and then return to tell me what they'd experienced.
Well, why didn't you go yourself?
Me? Me? You must be mad. At my time of life, in my state of health, risk the shock and dangers of being flung into a different universe, preposterous.
Think what another world means. You might meet anything, anything.
And I suppose you've sent Polly into it then?
Yes.
All I can say, even if you are my uncle, is that you've behaved like a coward.
Oh,
sending a girl to a place you're too afraid to go to yourself.
Silence! I will not be talked to like that by a little dirty schoolboy. No great wisdom can be reached without sacrifice. This is my experiment. Supposing I got killed, what would become of my life's work?
Oh, do stop jawing. Are you going to bring Polly back?
Well, I can't bring her back. She needs a green ring to return, and she doesn't have one.
Then she can't get back. It's exactly the same as if you'd murdered her.
She can get back if someone else will go after her, wearing a yellow ring himself and taking two green rings, one to bring himself back and one to bring her back.
Oh, so that's your game.
Oh, I hope, Diggory, that you won't be a coward, considering your lecture to me on the subject. I should be very sorry to think that anyone of our family hadn't enough honour and chivalry to go to the aid of a lady in distress.
Oh, shut up! If you had any honour and all that, you'd be going yourself. But I know you won't. All right. I see I've got to go. But you are a beast. You'll pay for this in the end. Your sort always do.
I think it'd be better for you to worry about your friends than about my sort. If there are any dangers over there, well, it would be a pity to arrive a moment too late.
A lot you care. But I'm sick of all your talking. What have I got to do?
Right. Well, you'll notice I'm wearing a pair of gloves. That's because the rings only work if they're actually touching bare skin. You see, if you carry one in your pocket, nothing happens. But, of course, you have to be careful not to put your hand in your pocket and touch it by accident. The moment you touch a yellow ring, you vanish out of this world. When you're in the other place, I expect, though of course it hasn't been tested yet, but the moment you touch a green ring, you vanish out of that world and reappear in this. Now, take these two greens and drop them into your right-hand pocket. Remember very carefully which pocket the greens are in. G for green, R for right, GR, gr. You see, first two letters of green.
All right, I understand that much. What about the yellow ring?
Well, I would suggest you put that one on your finger so you won't lose it. Go on.
Wait a minute. What about my mother? Supposing she asks where I am?
The sooner you go, the sooner you'll be back.
But you don't really know whether I can get back.
Oh, very well, then. Just as you please. Sit down, have your dinner. Leave the little girl to whatever dangers await her in the other world. Oh, perhaps before tea time, you'd better drop in on Mrs. Plummer and explain that she'll never see her daughter again because you were afraid to put on a ring.
Honestly, don't I just wish I was big enough to punch your head?
Go on, Diggory. Another world awaits you.
All right.
Diggory picked up the ring. And he thought then, as he always thought afterwards too, but he couldn't decently have done anything else. Uncle Andrew and his study vanished instantly. Then for a moment, everything became mottled. The next thing Diggory knew was that there was a soft green light coming down on him from above and darkness below. He didn't seem to be standing on anything, or sitting, or lying. Nothing appeared to be touching him. He thought he was in water, or worse, underwater. This frightened him for a second, but almost at once he could feel that he was rushing upward. Then his head suddenly came out into the air, and he found himself scrambling ashore, out onto a smooth, grassy ground, at the edge of a pool. Strangely, as he rose to his feet, he noticed that he was neither dripping nor panting for breath, as anyone would expect after being underwater. His clothes were perfectly dry. He was standing at the edge of a small pool, not more than 10 feet from side to side, in a wood. But it was not the only pool. There were dozens of others, a pool every few yards, as far as his eyes could reach. The trees grew close together, and was so leafy that he could get no glimpse of the sky. All the light was green light,
a green daylight that was bright and warm. It was the quietest wood you can imagine. There were no birds, no insects, no animals, and no wind. You could almost feel the trees growing. It was, as Diggory would describe later, a rich place. Surprisingly, Diggory was not frightened. In fact, he'd half forgotten how he'd come there or what he was supposed to do. He felt as if he'd always been there. After Diggory had looked around for a long time, he noticed that there was a girl lying on her back at the foot of a tree a few yards away. Her eyes were nearly shut, but not quite, as if she were between sleeping and waking. So he looked at her for a long time and said nothing. And at last she opened her eyes and looked at him.
I think I've seen you before. I rather think so too. Have you been here long?
Oh, always.
At least, I don't know.
A very long time.
So have I.
No, you haven't.
I've just seen you come up out of that pool.
Yes. I suppose I did. I'd forgotten.
Look here. I wonder. Have we met before? I have an idea, a sort of picture in my head. Of a boy and a girl like us, living somewhere else. And doing all sorts of things. Perhaps it's only a dream.
I've had the same dream, I think.
Oh. Hello. What's that? It's a guinea pig. Odd. It has a yellow ring tied to it. Just like the one you're wearing on your finger. Oh. You have one on your finger as well. Wait. Something is coming to me.
Yes.
Uncle Andrew! I remember now. He was beastly and tricked me.
He tricked me as well.
That's why I'm here. To take you back.
Is that it then? Do we take the guinea pig and go home?
No. You might as well leave the guinea pig. It's perfectly happy here. And your uncle will only do something horrid to it if we take it home.
Ooh, it's very nice for you, though.
There's no hurry. Stop it, Diggory! We've got to get back. Do you know how?
Well, I suppose we should take off the yellow rings, since they were the way in.
Done. And now, we put on these green rings. Right. And then what?
We go back into that pool, I expect.
But we haven't any bathing things.
We don't need them, remember? We didn't get wet on the way in.
Oh, I'd forgotten.
Ready to jump? On three.
Right.
One. Two.
Hang on. What's the matter? I've just had a really wonderful idea. What are all the other pools?
That's where we're going to stop the story tonight. Okay. Yes, I saw the reenacting all along.
It did help us to fully absorb the story.
Yeah. All right, so we have just a few minutes tonight. We need to talk about the characters. Really, Polly and Diggory, we've just seen a few little pieces and parts of them now. As far as characters, you're going to see a lot more of them as they go through. I would say something that they are is definitely adventurous, okay? And it seems as though Diggory is pretty sensitive, all right? He does care about Polly, whether she was gone or not. It wasn't like, well, I'm not going there no matter what. He also wanted to punch his uncle in the head, too, because he thought he was a pretty big jerk. And really, that's the guy we really want to talk about. That's the development that you see in the conversation. Uncle Andrew. That's the big character to look at tonight. Uncle Andrew. I want you to think about some of the conversation that he and Diggory had. What did they talk about? What was Andrew's focus? Not quite. Think. Yes, the other world, but himself. Why? For himself. Game. What game? What is he worried about?
The box. He's only worried about himself. He doesn't care about anyone else.
Why didn't he go?
His health. Because he doesn't
really
want to hurt himself. Excuse. He would rather someone else get hurt than him.
What was his? Why did he say I can't go? Because if I go,
his life's work.
There, my life's work. This is all about my life's work. My life's work would be lost. So what is that about? Why does he care about that? What's underneath all that?
Pride.
Pride? Yep. And he's willing to allow other people, first the guinea pig, right? But then he's like, this is the perfect place where you stopped, right? Two children, it's just what I need. Now why does he want two children?
So one can go in, one can go in after.
Why children though?
Because they're both.
Because he can manipulate them, right? And why does he give her, oh yeah, I guess you better go home. But first, you're such a beautiful girl, you need a ring. Right? And he uses that as a manipulation. He uses that to manipulate. He has power over those people, and he really thinks very highly of himself. He thinks that all of his life's work is more important than the people around him, right? More important than the people around him. Now, when we look at, he would rather allow them to undergo something so that he can get the glory, right? I'll let you do the work, and I'll make sure I stay safe, and I get the glory from it all. So that is, if we were to look, let's look at, let's look at Luke chapter number 11. Luke chapter 11. We see people in the Bible that Jesus talks about with the exact same qualities. And you might not think of them that way at first, but really, the way that Uncle Andrew approaches things is a very much like this, okay? Let's look at chapter 11 of Luke, verse number 46. Go ahead, read 46, please.
And he said, woe unto you also, ye lawyers, for ye laid men with burdens grievous to be borne, and ye yourselves touch not the burdens with one of your fingers.
All right, so Jesus is saying this, woe unto you, you lawyers. There's also in the other Gospels, he calls out scribes and Pharisees. Okay, she can go. Scribes and Pharisees. And says, the problem with the scribes and Pharisees is this. That they're so willing to take and put a burden on somebody else, but not willing to carry a burden themselves. Okay? These are people that are arrogant, people that believe that they're better than other people. Okay? And that is often the problem, is they believe that they are better than other people. Uncle Andrew is an arrogant guy. He believes that everything he does, he's a bit above everybody else. You remember when Diggory talked about telling the truth? And he had said, or doing what's right, right? He had said, you made a promise when the lady gave you the box that you'd destroy it after she died. That's where he got all the dust to make the rings out of. And he said, well, I didn't destroy it because it was too interesting. And Diggory said, but you made a promise. He said, but people like me aren't bound to promises because we're much higher than that, right? This is all about research. This is all about being smart and important, okay? I'm very smart and wise people, he said. We don't have to be bound to those little tiny rules. It's good for people like you, he said. But when you're really searching out the wisdom of the world, you don't have to do those things. And people that are wise don't have to follow that. All right? That's not a godly answer. All right? In fact, that's an answer in Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1, Paul talks about men of this world, okay, the way the world reacts to God. Chapter 1, verse number 21, I'll read that. Because that when they knew God, they glorified him not as God, neither were they thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. All right? And so what human beings do oftentimes is in the pursuit of wisdom, they say, well, we're going to seek after things and we're kind of above the other world. You'll find it oftentimes in some people that don't have God in their lives. Okay? But they say, well, I'm higher than God. I search out wisdom. And wisdom is higher than God. The problem is they don't know and they don't understand that God is wisdom. Wisdom started with God. All right? In Psalm chapter 14, we don't have time to turn there, but Psalm chapter 14, David says, the fool has said in his heart, in the translation it says, there is no God. But that's not really what the original script said. The original script just said, no God. So the fool has said in their heart, no God. And when you say, I will seek out wisdom despite doing what is right, despite not looking at that, I don't want to do that. I want to just be smart. Okay? When that becomes your main goal, and you begin to think that you're better than other people, you begin to think you think you're smarter. And then eventually, just like Satan did, you say, well, I'm smarter than God. I should be as good as God. That was Lucifer's sin in heaven, saying, I am just as smart or smarter than God. And I have a rightful place. Okay? So Diggory thinks he's above the law. He thinks he can put a burden on somebody, okay? And he says, this is my life's work. I'm too important to be doing all these dangerous things, because then no one would know if I discovered this great thing what it's all about. So I have to stay here while you go and do the work. You go take the danger. You go have that burden on you. And that's exactly what Jesus said. The Pharisees, the scribes, the lawyers were like that. In his day, the religious people were like that. You go do all of this. They would teach all the things you couldn't do. All the things that you'd be sinning for when you did it. And they teach all those things. But when it came down to it, they never helped anybody. But when Jesus came along, he said, that's not the way we approach it. He said, you know how we approach it? How do I approach it? I approach it in such a way, Matthew 11, this is where we'll look at Christ and what his approach is. Matthew chapter 11.
Verse number 25 through 30. So if we want to pick up and go there, just 25 through 30, please.
At the time, Jesus answered and said, I thank thee, O Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because thou hast hid these things from the wise and prudent, and hast revealed them unto babes.
Even so, Father, for so it seemed good in thy sight.
All things are delivered unto me of my Father, and no man knoweth the Son but the Father. Neither knoweth any man the Father, save the Son, and he to whomsoever the Son will reveal.
Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest.
Take my yoke upon you, and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls.
For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light.
All right, so instead of what the Pharisees said, how they approached life, which was burden other people with my things. I make up the rules, you live by it. Okay? Jesus said, you never lift a finger to help those people in those burdens. He said, what I do, though I am the maker of all knowledge, though I understand things, though I see things that you don't see, I come to help you. I come to take your burden. I come to share it with you. Come with me and walk through this with me. He says, that's what Uncle Andrew does not do. Right? He is totally thinking of himself, totally putting burdens on other people. You could never possibly be as smart as me, as important as me, as interesting as I am. You can go and go off into the world with the guinea pig. I can't do that. Well, I'm too old. My health's too this. No, it's nothing to do with that. That's all just cover. And that's why he uses manipulation to get people to do things. And how does he get Diggory to put the ring on?
He guilt trips him,
right? Oh, you'd be a coward, wouldn't you? The very thing you gave me a lecture on. You're going to be a coward if you don't do it. And Diggory has just a little bit more of quality in him that's good. That says, I'll do this. Okay? We're going to see some of the things that Diggory's going to struggle with. He's going to struggle with doing the right thing as time goes on. All right? He's going to have come up with these things where he's got to make a choice. And sometimes he makes a good choice, sometimes he doesn't make a good choice. All right? And we're going to see where he digs just a little bit into things where he shouldn't dig. And he's going to get in trouble. And he's going to open up a world that he never knew would happen. All right? But understand this, you're going to see Uncle Andrew, he's going to appear back through the story. Understand where he's coming from. He is not just a crazy old uncle. He really is a very arrogant person. And arrogant people, it is very tough to live Christ-like life if all you can think about is yourself. Because Christ didn't think that way. Christ thought about other people. He said, I will help you with your burden. I won't tell you how smart I am and how much you have to do to get as good as me. He said, I'm just going to tell you how I can help you. I'm going to help you where you are. I'm not trying to impress you. I'm just here to help you. Okay? And that is exactly the way Christ approaches it. So look at Uncle Andrew. As we put him in the story, you're going to find he's going to go through a little bit of a transformation. He's going to see, but first he's going to get this guy who is great and kind of in control at this point. He's going to lose control eventually. Right now, he's got all the control. He's got all the rings. He's got all the manipulation. And he uses it to move people in the way he wants them. Kind of like little chess pieces. But eventually, he runs out of that. And he gets in trouble. All right? We'll pick up next week. Thank you very much.